Welcome to the Afflicted and Affected. My name is Chris Schroeder, and it is the purpose of this webcast to host prominent guests from the fields of addictive illness treatment and other personalities involved in recovery processes. It will be our goal to educate both the professional and non-professional in the most modern and effective treatment methods and highlight some other resources that are available. Tonight's guest is Bill McNiff. Bill is an actor, writer, and director who spent the last 30 years developing a handful of plays that basically talk about and talk to the origin of the 12-step movement and the people who were critically involved in that movement. His first play, Moments, performing that for 20 years all over the world to tens of thousands of people. Bill, thank you so much for being on the show tonight with us.
It's a privilege. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Let's talk a little bit about you. What in the world brought you to the place where you would write a play like Moments and then start performing it? Where did you get that idea? What was going on in your life at that time?
Well, of course, like everything, it began with my own recovery. And then for some reason that I'm still baffled by, I developed an interest in the origins of the fellowship. When I first came to the rooms, I didn't care for any of the principles. Well, I didn't care for anybody. I loathed everything that I saw. But little by little, of course, they chipped away, and I got down to the basic fact of my own reality and became deeply interested in the program. So I began to read everything that I found available, not only on the alcoholism, but on the characters that played a part in developing AA and the 12-step program. And that just grew to the point that I've started to share that information on visits. My ministry for a while, my AA ministry was to prisons, and I also just enlarged that to rehabs, and I began to talk about the principles, but it fell flat. I could see people nodding off as I gave them times and dates and places where all of this began. You know, I was a walking archivist, and what I was intrigued by was some fellows would come up after the meeting, and they were really deeply interested in the personalities and the character of the two main players, Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson, and Bill W. And I began to think about, why don't I, you know, make a presentation on just those two fellows and how their lives came about, and then their interests, of course, in their own recovery, and they're helping each other. But nothing was clicking with me for a long time, because I was writing a many-parted, or I was putting together through notes. I bought one of the first word processors that ever came out, and that made it a lot easier to manage. And little by little, I began to develop some characters. And I was fortunate for a while that I was working up in New York City, commuting from where I live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I'd go up, I had an apartment up there, and I came across some people who were there at the beginning. One in particular, who I adopted as my New York sponsor in the program, Gene Fireheart, God rest his soul. He was Bill's driver, Bill Wilson's driver.
Really?
And he began to give me some, he gave me some anecdotes about Bill that I really found intriguing. And then by just pure chance, I was rereading, I get them mixed up. I think it was AA Comes of Age or Pass It On. There's a photograph of Bill Wilson behind the podium, and below at the caption says, wherever he went, Bill told his story to a captive, attentive audience. Wherever he showed up, Bill would tell his story. And I said, you know, he was dead, of course, then. And I said, you know, somebody should tell his story. That would be the simplest way to portray this. You know, I would just tell his story. So I began to just lean more on Bill. What was his story like? And then one day I said, what reason would Bill have to tell his story? As simple as that. What would he do? Why would he be at a place telling his story? Although it happened wherever he went, he was asked to tell his story. But why this particular night he's going to tell his whole story and bring Dr. Bob to it.
And is this where you came up with the Kipps Bay?
And the day that Bob died.
Right.
That he's summoned. He comes to the meeting reluctantly. He'd rather stay home. And through a suggestion from the Jesuit down in St. Louis, Father Dowling, he tells their story instead of his story.
Okay.
On the day that Bob died. And that just began to develop. And again, it was kind of flat, nothing striking to it. But as I got out of the details, more into the personalities of the people and their foibles, and developed some self-deprecating humor around Bill, because he was fairly known for his own self-deprecation. You know, he would tell jokes on himself constantly, you know, his own failings. And I began to, through anecdotes, enlarge the story, and before you know it, I had 120 minutes of the day that they titled it, The Day That Dr. Bob Died, against my wishes, and finally got back to moments. There's a quotation in Bill's life where it says, there were moments in his life, and he gave his life to those moments.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's Thompson's biography of Bill Wilson. Somewhere in there, that I came across that quote. So moments just came off the page, and I said, share some moments about this guy. And it began to get some legs, and people became interested in it, and I began to travel with it. You know, I mean, extensively. I'm talking about California to Canada, Mexico once, Texas, Florida, you name it. I've been all over most of the country. Very little in the Midwest, unfortunately, and Ohio, of course. And it just developed. And out of that, one day, somebody in Akron, I was in Akron, so wanted to tell Bob's story. So I decided to write Bob's story, which would be called Scape Dream,
right?
Which is a dream that he has just before he dies. He gets to tell his story. And I built that around the fact that when he spoke for the last time in 1950 to the 15-year international convention in Cleveland, his story was cut short because he was very sick. And I wondered what would he have said had he been given the amount of time that he needed to tell his story. So I put it in a dream. And I stole that actually from Shakespeare. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little lives are rounded in the sleep. So mm-hmm. that was. And then from that, somebody said, why don't you write something about Lois? So I wrote a play called Reflections about her. And I was too young to play her, so I got a gal to do it. And we were very fortunate at the time. The fellow that was running the management of their home, Stepping Stones, up in the Westchester County, up in Bedford Hills,
mm-hmm.
They allowed us to film that in front of their fireplace in what Wilson used to call the Great Room. And that became Reflections. And it finally got, it was only done one live appearance by the actress that did it in the film. She did it for to raise some money for a Princeton club, an AA club in Princeton. And then we filmed her doing it at the fireplace, and then she passed away. And 3 weeks ago, I had a young actress do it up in Scranton. She might be able to travel with it, because it's a nice little piece of work. And finally, this last thing that we're trying to get going is Genesis, which was the first meeting between Bill and Bob at the Gatehouse in Akron.
No, I've listened to this. It's absolutely phenomenal, Bill. The key pivotal moment, I think, for 12-step recovery, for there to be an escape from addictive illness. The key moment really happened, I believe, in the Cyberling Gatehouse, and that's really where this play takes place, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah. So it's just. I mentioned briefly in all the other plays that I do, because nobody has any record of it. So I could go freelance on this one. I could go in any direction I wanted. But knowing a lot about both of the characters, and having interviewed people in Akron and in New York, and again my own experience traveling around with them, I've sort of gotten under their skin. And so I thought, what would it be like for Bob when he showed up? And I take to heart to your suggestion that you gave me the other day about these two guys were wisecrackers, you know. I know Bob always had a nickname for everybody that he came across. Uh-huh. A lot of times it wasn't flattering, you know. He just would, and Bill too. Bill Wilson was kind of a Damon Runyon-esque character, you know. He tried to give off an attitude that was like not so much a tough guy, but a street smart. Mm-hmm. Somebody that knew his way around, you know, and of course he wasn't. He was a country bumpkin from Vermont, you know, but he too had a, you know, he was a wisecracker too. And he was a bit of a practical joker, you know, not a painful way. Uh-huh. But he did some things. And there was so much that I could put into it, but I didn't. Sure. I wanted to keep it about an hour, a little over an hour. And what came out of that room is the reason we're here, you know, talking right now.
It's certainly the reason why.
For me, it's a profound miracle.
Yeah,
What's that?
It's certainly the reason why I'm here.
Yeah, no, and it's just the whole aspect. The thing, if my dying breath, hopefully, it's a long way off, but I hope it would be the key to AA is service. Mm-hmm. It's you know, I was at a meeting the other day and a new fellow. We were talking about action, you know, and he took the first line of the 12th step in the 12 and 12 and said the joy of recovery is in action, you know. And that's the thing, that's the biggest failing that I see today is the inaction. People that are, unfortunately, like to say they're hanging in there. You know, God bless them. I mean, they're hanging in there, but they're not getting the joy that they would get out of this if they just got off their butt and found a drunk to take out.
The biggest change I've seen looking at Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's become a fellowship-based sobriety system instead of a program-based recovery system. There just seems to be so many people who want to sit in a chair and really do the easy thing. When you're right, it takes a service ethic. It takes a lot of giving of oneself. And, you know, there's a lot of latitude to how one can do that. But the majority of what you can see if you look in the rooms are people coming in to get, you know, they want to sit and get. And that's really not, you know, really not how it was designed.
Yeah, no. I mean, they're managing to stay sober. I mean, they're fulfilling the only requirement. You know, they're maintaining their sobriety, but there's no joy. There's no
quality.
Yeah, yeah. They know all the cliches, and I'm sorry, I'm taking their inventory, and I shouldn't do it, but I don't despair, because like I said, I'll become a pain in the butt as much as possible by telling people you're missing out. And I'm not just talking about 12-step work, I'm talking about, we used to call it the 20-20. Show up 20 minutes before the meeting and 20 minutes after. That's where the fellowship is. That's where the camaraderie, that's where the leg pulling goes on, and you know, was said by the psychiatrist, the Tebow, Bill's shrink, AA has the ability of cutting people down to size. And, you know, we sort of miss that if we don't get in early and stay late, you know, and get to know people. You know, I go to a morning meeting, and I know everybody's face, but I know nothing about them. Mm-hmm. Nothing at all, you know, what they do for a living, you know, are they married, unmarried? You know, I mean, a few I do know, but when you get 30, 40, 50 people in a room and you might know a little bit about five of them in the room, that's not the way it was when I appeared on the scene. You know, we know almost everything about each other. We had an assets program then. That was the word they used with the group assets. How many lawyers, how many bankers, how many cops, how many actors, how many writers, reporters, grocery clerks, so that when somebody showed up in a like profession, we coupled them together. Yeah. Hey, I remember a banker coming in from, my beginnings was on the Massachusetts-Rhode Island line, and
okay.
A banker came in from Rhode Island, and we hooked him up with a banker in Massachusetts.
Sure.
Because we knew how difficult it must be for a banker to walk into an AA meeting. I mean, people are giving him his money. You know? This guy's a drunk. I'm not going to give him my money. You know? I mean, this is when when banking was at a more personal level than it is today.
Sure.
But that doesn't occur anymore. You know, I did have a case the other day of hooking up a car salesman with another car salesman, because I think those fellas getting sober is a little extra more work involved in it, you know.
You have to develop some of the even really bad character defects. You have to develop them to a fine science sometimes to be selling there. You know?
That's right, yeah. But they hit it off, which is good. You know, that's the only thing they had in common besides their drinking and perhaps one of them drugging. I wasn't that deep into their stories, but they had this other thing in common, you know, and I always go back. I don't know if you remember the story about Bill Wilson when he took his grandfather to the 50th reunion of the Battle of Gettysburg.
No.
And it's in Thompson's biography. They went down, they camped out for a week. This is Mr. Griffith. And he watched, while he was there, Wilson watched these men, both Confederate and Union soldiers, walking arm in arm, hand in hand sometimes, around the battlefield, pointing out where they were that day, you know, or that weekend. And he came up with the line of, what these men had in common is far greater than anything that would tear it apart. And that's AA. When you, what we have in common, our illness, is what keeps us. But then if you can find more in common, it just sort of solidifies the relationship, you know. It makes it more than just the addiction, the alcoholism.
Now,
and the fact that one is sober and the other one might be new and not really sober yet. So,
that's true.
That's why I love AA.
Being someone who has really studied the roots, the genesis of the 12-step movement. What are some of the other things that you see people might be getting wrong today? Because the success rates just don't seem to be anywhere near what was bragged about in some of the earlier forwards to say the forward to the second edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't seem like we're doing as good a job within the 12-step fellowships these days. What do you think are some of the things that we're getting wrong?
Well, the mistakes began when the political climate began to change, when we became politically correct, for lack of a better word, you know, or in this book, correct. We have a hesitancy to tell people the foundation of AA, the absolute rock bed of AA comes out of the Bible. You know, I'm sure you, if you play this, half the people will turn it off for now. Boom, goodbye. And I'm not a Bible thumper. I've read the Bible since I was in recovery. I didn't read it before, and I think it's very interesting. And it has value, you know.
That's a soft way to say it. Really, even more accurately, it came from a very evangelical branch of Christianity.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Profoundly non-denominational. I mean, these were really fundamentalists.
Yeah.
The Oxford Group people were fundamentalists. I mean, you could belong to, most of them were Methodists, but Bookman was a Lutheran. You know, the guy, Frank Bookman, the guy that kicked it off. But Shoemaker, I think Reverend Shoemaker, the fellow from the Calvary Church in New York, was their liaison with Bookman. And he was Bill's spiritual mentor, Bill Wilson's. I mean, sat at this guy's knee and learned the early precepts of the Oxford Group that were not all of the precepts, but the ones that most touched on an alcoholic's life. And they came up with their principles, which were, get honest, talk it over with somebody else, make up for the harm you've done, try to help other people, and ask God for help to do those four things. That was the whole ethos. But then they went out to proselytize, to carry the message. They carried the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, they walked into something like when Bob would walk into the hospital, he had a Bible in his hand. Now, of the Bible, they found the most pertinent parts of it were the three books, the Book of James, Paul's letter to the Corinthians on love and
the Sermon on the Mount.
The Sermon on the Mount, yeah. Right. And after that, they actually stopped using the Bible, and they went to Emmett Fox's interpretation of the Sermon on the Mount, who was a great orator at that time, you know. Mm-hmm. But Bill Wilson once labeled himself before, even during the early parts of it, he was an agnostic to a degree. I mean, he was still uncertain. He liked to describe himself as an Ingersoll inclined transcendentalist. And I've tried to find Ingersoll all over the place. There's some Ingersoll lecture somewhere. But I think he was a guy that read Thoreau and read Walden, read Emerson and Hawthorne, and had some basic ideas, not on religion, but on spirituality.
Certainly New Thought spirituality was...
That's right. Yeah. That's right. New Thought. I haven't heard that word in a while. New Thought. Yeah, which was... And even Dr. James, William James, was of that ilk. You know, he believed in that or followed that course in his own spirituality. So Bill had this, and they had success, but they were... Basically, in the first 2 years, they were talking men just like themselves. Mm-hmm. Majority of them were professionals, mm-hmm. people that had a lot to lose if they didn't get in recovery. I think it was Clarence Snyder began to branch out from the non-professionals to get some other people. But in the beginning, they were all white Protestant men,
yeah.
that were attracted to what do they call them, the alcoholic squad of the Oxford group, you know.
Yes.
that was the name that they used, and they pledged their secrecy. It was a secret society, very quiet, you know. They when they wanted to discuss their alcoholism, they broke away from the Oxford group meeting and went to another room and shared there. But their whole premise before they would entertain anybody coming into the group was that person had to surrender to Christ.
Yeah.
And they had a prayer. It was fashioned later on into the third step prayer that we use today. But it was I had it somewhere. I just can't. I don't know where I put it. But these people got down on their knees and professed their willingness to follow the direction of these newly sober drunk, which was pretty heroic, you know. I think and pretty profound. And so as we've sort of say right now, the recovery rate then was pretty good. I mean, when somebody went through that process, you know, maybe
and stayed
5 days
and
a
yeah, and then and then stayed active, go through the process.
That's right. Oh yeah,
stay active. And almost all of them would stay sober.
That's right. And during, you know, AA was born out of poverty. I mean, there was no money available, yet these guys were shelling out money to put the guys in the hospital. I mean, it was certainly not anywhere near what it's cost today, not even close. It was a fraction of what we charge today. But these guys were willing to do that and sit alongside them in the hospital and talk to them and read from that Bible, you know. And as I said in the little play on Dr. Bob, I have Bob saying, you don't have to be a believer in the Bible to accept the validity of the 12 steps. You know, you don't. And it goes on to talk about Euclid's axioms. His theories are not proven, yet we fly in planes, we cross bridges, we live in tall buildings, and they don't fall down on us because of those unproven theories. But AA's 12 steps are 12 proven theories. You know, and you can see it in the lives of the people that are sober.
Absolutely.
You know, we go through this process of recovery. Some people take... do it in a very short time, and some people it takes forever. And my own journey through that was very difficult. When I showed up in the fellowship, there was no discussion of the 12 steps. All we talked about in those days was don't drink, come to meetings. And not even get a sponsor. I'm serious. It was suggested. But I remember, and of course there was no discussion. If you wanted to discuss something, you stayed after the meeting and talked about it. We would, in the course of an hour and a half, we'd have maybe 6 to 8 speakers get up and talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now.
Yeah.
And a chairperson was sort of like an interlocutor from the old vaudeville days, you know. He'd interject in between speakers, but we'd have these people get up, and in an hour and a half, you got a lot of recovery. You got, I mean, some people, I forget what the criteria was. I think you had to be sober a month. So I just can't remember. But you'd have a month, or there was one fellow that showed up who I was certain, dead certain, was a paid agent of AA. This guy was paid to go there, because wherever I went, there he was. This guy's getting paid, you know. But I was a reluctant groom when I came here. I wasn't court ordered or anything like that, but if I didn't do something about my drinking, I was finished. And it took a while, but it was just chipping away little by little. People got up and said some aspect of their life, their story, whether it was the drunken side of it or the sober side of it, that I identified with. And I said, my God, you know, I thought that way, I felt that way, I did that, or thank God I never did that, even got to that point, you know. And before you know it, I woke up one morning and said, I'm an alcoholic. And boom.
Yeah, it's funny, you can catch alcoholism in the fellowship. You, while you're dying of it, you don't have it. but you know, you come in and you know somebody helps you catch a bad case of it. It truly is funny.
I haven't thought of that. Well, I did say, you know, I was sent to my first meeting with my wife, and I was seeing a shrink in Boston, and he suggested I check these people out. And I was tipsy when I showed up. But I remember saying to my wife, let's get out of here before we catch this. That's like something you can catch. But that's how much, I mean, although I was raised, my whole family, I come from a long tribe of Irish drunks. I mean, we studied deep in alcoholism, believe me, you know, and I knew of AA, but I'd always just attached it to some arm of the Episcopal Church, because in those days they used to call themselves Episcoholics, because they were the only people that opened the doors for them up in on my neck of the woods. You know, wherever you went, it was an Episcopal Church that had an AA meeting. And I just thought that this AA is a branch of the Episcopal Church.
Oh, that's funny.
And again, because there was no depth to me at all, I didn't want to know. I suffered from compounded ignorance. I didn't know that I didn't know. It just got better because of what I said. I just came and I sat. I had nowhere else to go. Mm-hmm. And over the course of time, and I don't know when that happened, but one day I woke up and knew that I was one of them. And that was sort of like opened up the beginnings, the very, very beginnings of trying to find out who these people were, you know, that had this effect on my life. And, the more you get interested in it, the more you look into it, the more it just grows on you. That this thing is profound and it's divine.
It's profound and it's divine. And when you look at outcomes, the people who really seriously engage in the work that Bill and Bob and some of the other originating members put together, when you engage in that work, you can recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body called addictive illness. And that is significant. There's been a lot of people who've tried to do things that are better, that are more effective, that are more scientifically plausible than a spiritual awakening. But there still is nothing that has the success history than you know, AA and the other 12-step fellowships.
That's right. No, as I said, going back to that article about it, it's the best thing available. It's the only thing right now that works. I mean, I'm sure that someday if somebody's going to come up with a pill or something, or a book or some hypnosis, I don't care what it is, and he'll say, all right, you'll never drink again, but they don't give him. But there's nothing behind that.
There's no increase in quality of life. You get a quality of life.
Gives you a bottle of pills. Unless this fellow gives you a bottle of pills to take to other people and give to them.
That's true.
Yeah, you know, there's nothing behind this. Yeah, you know, my late sponsor, God rest his soul, he said something once. He said, you know, AA is intimacy without involvement. He said, if you go to a meeting that's a good meeting, you can get very intimate with these people. You're not going to take them home with you, but you're going to learn more there. And it's because it strikes a chord inside of you. You know, it's so dramatic. You know, if you go with the right intent, and that's to learn. I I was at a meeting this morning and I had to share it again. I come here to learn. Please tell me something I don't know, or remind me of something I have forgotten. Because I'm still an alcoholic. I do identify myself as a recovered alcoholic, just to see their eyes light up.
But, yeah. Well, it's because you are, for one thing. Yeah.
but again, to some people, you know, that my God, I'm committing a heresy, and I say no. I just go with what the early people said of themselves, you know. And my God, after 40 years, you know, I think to say less would be to sort of downplay AA's effectiveness. I love the story of when I was living in Boston, a fellow that was delivering liquor. He was in AA sober a couple of years, and he was delivering liquor to some of the buyers' houses in Wellesley outside of Boston and for Christmas time. At Christmas time, gifts, you know, payoffs, I guess you'd call them. And he went to the back door of this mansion, and he knocked on the door, and he had a case of liquor for them. And the woman that answered the door was delighted, and she said, "Wait a minute." And she went back, and she came back with a shot of whiskey for him. And he said, "I'm sorry, lady." He said, "I'm an alcoholic." And the woman said, "Oh, my God, I'm sorry. I'll be right back." And she came back with a tumblerful. And he said, you know, after that, he said, "I'm in AA, and that doesn't happen anymore, you know." But she came back with a full glass full of whiskey for him. That's how she interpreted being an alcoholic. Well, that sort of was a catalyst. But this is, again, my opinion. I mean, you can call yourself whatever you want, you know. And we had one man, a fellow that I used to see at all the meetings when I first showed up. His name was Walter, and his wife, his name was Millie. She would come along with him. They sat in the front row, and what I was impressed about him most of all is he leaned forward when the person was speaking. He wanted to hear every word. Well, Walter always introduced himself as, "My name is Walter, and I'm powerless over alcohol." Never once did I hear him say that he was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. So, but that was, God bless him, you know, and he certainly helped me, you know. It's 40 years ago, and I still remember Walter. Isn't that remarkable, you know?
Sure.
I can't remember the face of the bartender that pushed that poison down me for a number of years, but I can always remember Walter, so that's one of the positive things.
It is. We're about out of time, Bill, but what I'd like to end with is on Icons Anonymous, which is the website where there's a lot of your information. That's iconsanonymous.com. It says that your greatest satisfaction was to present the work to four men in a locked cell inside a Canadian prison. Can you share that experience with us?
Oh, sure. Yeah, Owen Sound, Canada, which is in the northernmost part of the western part of Ontario. I was invited. When I used to go to Canada, I would do like three or four performances, either in Toronto or the environs, Ontario. And I've traveled most of the five provinces, you know, the Maritimes and Quebec and Ontario. And so I was invited by a retired Canadian Army captain and another policeman. He was a Royal Mounted policeman, a Canadian Royal Mountie, and to a town called Owen Sound, which is on the Owen Sound, I guess, that leads up to Hudson Bay. Anyway, it took a long drive. We went up. I learned one thing as we're driving up. Every town is separated by the distance it would take a person to walk carrying a load of maybe 80 pounds or something. Every 20 kilometers we come to a town or 20 miles. I forget now. But we go to this prison, and it was an absolute dungeon. The walls were like, it was like an old, old Western-style jail. Mm-hmm. But it's the provincial, it's a county prison for that part of it. It's not a state prison.
Okay.
Or I forget, I've been in so many prisons. So Curtis Bay is like a 800, 900 inmate population, which is in Kingston. This has had 50 men. And of that, there were four men that made up the AA group in that prison. Now, to show you how old it was, the recreation room had just as much space to hold a ping pong table. And to get to one side of the table from the other, you had to crawl under the table. That was the amount of room that they gave to recreation. And then they brought me along these tiers to this six-man cell. And two of the fellas that were in the cell were not in AA. And the four fellas that were in there, there was six little individual cells, enough room to put a cot in, and then the door, the iron door closed behind you. And up against the wall were two tables that came down so they could eat. There was no mess halls there. The food was delivered to them three times a day.
Okay.
And there was two native Canadians, Indians. One of them was addicted to huffing gasoline, but he was an AA member because he was a drunk too, but all he loved to do was huff gas. And I never tried it, so I don't know what it does for you. And the other three were AA, and they sat, and there was just enough room. The other two guys got out of the place. I don't know where they put them. Maybe they let them play ping pong. I don't know. But I got in the cell, and my two hosts that brought me there had to stand outside on the tier, the walkway. And I did my play in front of them. Now, for the first 5 minutes, they looked at me like I had two heads. Because I'm talking about Brooklyn and Kips Bay and all that. But one of them had knew the story, knew the AA story, and apparently they had a big book, and they read the big book, but the way I tell the story, it isn't in the big book. You know, the way it comes out, it doesn't come that way. But when I began to realize what it was, and I have it's a shortened version. When I go into prison, I can only keep it about an hour is all they allow me to. They don't like that many people in the prisons that I go to be congregating more than that. So.
Sure.
So I gave them this hour presentation, and it was profound for me. I nearly wept at the end of it because these people, I have their attention. And what they said is they had never heard the hope that was in the program until I gave them that talk. They never found hope in the book is what they were trying to say. I guess it'd be difficult just having one person was the reader. The two Indians, the two native Canadians, they didn't read it all. And the one guy that read the story, read the big book to him. But this sort of put it together for me, and I was really, really affected by it. And so, as far as I'm concerned, that was the greatest performance that I ever gave because it touched me more than anything else.
Wow.
You know, that I, you know, that it, what it was is it was the reason why I wrote the play. It finally was some fulfillment for me from a really profound level. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, and I have fortunately over the years gotten to talk to a lot of people and perhaps encourage them to come along the same path as me. And I'm happy with the fact that I don't know, for the most part, if I did have an effect or not. I don't stick around for the applause, put it that way, you know.
Right.
But when I saw the response from these guys, for me it was profound. Absolutely. I mean, there were tears in my eyes when I got out of there, and I couldn't thank the people enough for bringing me there. And I've been in prison before. Like I said, I'll be in Lenoir, the state prison down in North Carolina in October. I just came from the Morgan County Jail outside of Knoxville, north of Oak Ridge, where James Earl Ray died, who's still a hero to those people. The guy that shot Martin Luther King. And I've done the play for, like in the Butler camp up in New York, 700 convicts. Again, I enjoy doing it. I think they got a lot out of it, but nothing will beat those four guys in that prison. I mean, that you had to be there. It's the only way I can describe it. And then to my, I'm not in touch with those two fellows that brought me up there, but when I get a Canadian, I always like to tell them, they introduced me to the worst Chinese meal I ever had in my life. I'm in a Chinese restaurant, and they give me some boiled potatoes. I don't know how many Chinese restaurants you go to where they serve you boiled. I wouldn't let them forget. All the way back to Toronto, I just kidded them about that Chinese meal. And they thought it was great. These guys thought, oh, this is great. Chinese. In Owen Sound to have a Chinese restaurant.
Oh, I've got a Canadian story for you, Bill. I'm speaking at a conference up there, and you know there's about 400 people or whatever, and I'm the Saturday night keynote, and they had a big banquet prior to me getting up there. So because we were the speakers and everything, we got to get in line first for the food. So we pretty much were the first people to be eating. Now, as I'm about three quarters of the way through my meal, somebody runs up to the front and grabs the microphone and says, "Everyone, don't eat the potatoes. Don't eat the potatoes." And everybody's going, "Why?" And he goes, "We found slugs in the potatoes."
Oh, and my goodness.
I had finished mine off.
Oh. Too late.
And then 3 minutes later, I had to get up and speak for an hour.
It didn't cause any distress, I hope.
No, it actually made...
Believe it, I love Canada. I've been all over, my business for years, I used to go to Canada, too, and I just love them, and I love the AA. I went to a meeting once in Moncton, where they read Robert's Rule of Law before the beginning. They have talk about old business, new business, they have a treasurer's report, and then they have a guy gets up and report about the meeting they had the week before. Charlie Solis, I got up. It was fascinating for me. The only thing they stopped doing is we didn't stand up and salute the Queen before the meeting. It was just absolutely. But I love the Canadians, and I love their AA. You know, if you ever get to, I go to Niagara Falls, I go to Buffalo, and then I'll go over to the Falls to go to a meeting. And it's the only place where it's almost mandatory. You get thrown out of the fellowship if you don't do it. Everybody that walks into the room has to go around and shake hands with everybody that's in the room.
Oh, that's funny.
And I think it's delightful. You know, I try to get it going here. They all tell me to go jump in the lake. You know,
I'll bet they did.
But we walk around the room and shake hands. But that's Canadian. I do. They're very, very dear to me. God bless them. But those four, I don't know whatever happened to those boys, those young men. They were young, and their circumstances were horrible. There's no question about it. And I don't think it's from... you know, a lousy attitude. It's just there just wasn't any money at the time. This was about 15 years ago.
And
I'm sure today the circumstances. I've been to the other prisons where they're beautiful. I mean, I was at the one in Curtis Bay. It looks like the Disney World, like a castle. And you go in there, and the facilities are perfect, and the AA is just absolutely just wonderful. And of course, they have a big problem with the native Canadians, so they had smoke lodges there for me to go in and visit, you know, and talk to those guys, and just the right attitude. Now, Chris, we're blessed people. I mean, there's no question about it.
We are the luckiest
people on the face of the earth, and the one thing that we can't do, and that's what I try not to do, is to take it for granted. This is a gift that, unearned grace.
We are, you know? We're overpaid in every way, except maybe sometimes financially.
Yeah, that's all right. I haven't missed the meals that I've been doing.
Anyway, listen.
And that's the important thing.
You know, Bill, I want to personally thank you. It was about 1993 or maybe 1992 when in Bernardsville, New Jersey, you put on your play. Life of Bill Wilson. And, you know, I still remember it. Listen, there's been a million meetings I've been in and out of in the last 20 years, but I still very much.
That was a meeting. I met Geraldine.
Geraldine Delaney, sure.
Yes, she was there. I remember that. It was their anniversary, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Geraldine O. Delaney, God.
The person who started Elena Lodge.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was stunning. Just then, and I had heard a lot about her before that, so it was a pleasure to meet her. But I remember that night too. I don't remember you, but I remember. Nothing against you.
No,
I met Joe Martin. The first time I heard Father Martin years ago was 1971, and he came down. I was living in Virginia at the time. I was sober about a little over a year, and still mad at the world. But he touched me, and I remember. Meeting him maybe 20 years later at his place.
Father Martin Ashley, yeah.
And I went up and I said, I loved him. He was kind of ill at the time. I might have taken advantage of him, but he got a big kick out of it. I said to him, do you remember me? He said, no. And I said, well, why is that? I remember you. And he loved it. He was such a personality. Why should he want to remember me? But God bless him.
He was the original recovery comedian, too.
Yeah, no, and he had a life. Well, he had that twinkle. That was the Irish. You know, God bless us. We have this little gift. I'm ringing my own bell here, but he had it in spades. And he did me a favor. When I met him for the first time, he was actually with the Maryland Highway Department. And the Navy had just, Joe Birch just made that film for him.
Chalk Talk.
First Chalk Talk, yeah. And fortunately for me, when the thing that gave, I don't know if you have time, you don't have to include this, but the thing, the biggest break that I got out of doing this was somebody invited me down to Betty Ford's place in California to do my presentation for, they had, during the winter months at the Annenberg Theater, which is on that property, the Bob Hope property there, the Eisenhower Pavilion, I think they call it, after Dwight Eisenhower. There's an Annenberg Theater, and they have once a week during the winter time when all the rich people come down from wherever they come from, they have a series of lectures, and Mrs. Ford, or not her, but somebody invited me down to do my little thing, the moments thing. And I'd missed my, they lost my luggage, I was sick. It was a terrible storm. I flew out of Baltimore. It was real horrible to get there, and I got there without luggage, and I got up the next day with a sore throat and no change of clothes, no props. I didn't even have a big book. I had to borrow one. And I did my thing. They were trying to raise money for a Caduceus Society of the graduates of the Betty Ford Center to have medical people, pharmacists, doctors, dentists, form a little group of alumni. You know, again, that thing, like unto like. So when they get a dentist getting out, they can introduce them to another dentist, I guess. So they just begged for money for that. And then I came on, and I was beginning to realize that at the rate I was going, this thing was going to kill me. So I said, is there anybody, I said, please give your money. There was a lot of rich people there. It's like a science theater. You look up at the audience, you know, they're not in front of you, they're up above you. And I looked up and I said, please give the money to the Caduceus Society, but if you got a couple of bucks together, can somebody come up with the money to help me produce a video of what I just did?
Wow.
You know, because I said, I said, in case I can't make it, I can send a video, you know. That was my whole purpose behind it. I'll mail it to you. Like the reason they wrote the big book is because they couldn't send people out to see people, so they sent the book. You know? And there was no response, but I'm standing at the door ready to leave, and a little redheaded woman comes up to her, and Mrs. Ford, and she said, well, help us. We'll help you.
Wow.
And she got a hold of Hazleton, and Hazleton chipped in with them, and they came up with the dough to film it right at where I did it, right at the Annenberg Theater.
Wow.
About 5 months later, you know, so I'm very grateful for that one trip, you know. That I was reluctant. It was a horrible blizzard here. It was just getting to the Baltimore airport was like a trial. And I got down there, and this lovely woman came up and said, well, help her. And then I told a stupid joke to the first lady.
Oh, no.
I lived the next town over from them when Nixon quit. I was down there living in Virginia. I was in a town called Vienna, and they were in Arlington, or two towns over. And I thought it was interesting that the day that Jerry Ford was selected to be vice president, some reporters came to his house, and they interviewed him in his kitchen while he was buttering an English muffin.
Oh boy!
All right. And I said, I always remember that, you know, and not realizing this is just how stupid I was. She was too drunk to come down and do it for him. And she said to me, she just touched my hand. She said, that's okay. She said, I do it for him now. You know, it was so obvious that was the reason why she wasn't there. She was too hungover. And, but she says, I butter his muffins now. And I said, why the hell did I have to tell that?
Oh, that's funny.
I mean, the only thing I remember of the President of the United States is the fact that he buttered his own English muffin, you know. So every time I think of that, making an ass out of myself, I shudder. You know, I said, oh, why did I have to? But she was just absolutely, I needed a goose at that time for what I was doing, and she gave it to me. She was just wonderful.
I'll tell you what, I interviewed on the show a couple of years ago the individual who was tasked with doing the intervention on her. And in the middle of the intervention, when she realized what was going on, she left the room and had the Secret Service drag the interventionist off the property.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Was it Hal Marley? Or?
I
love it.
Just a really, really great story.
Oh, yeah. Listen, I was there when the Wilbur Mills showed up. And you don't have to take this is one of the best stories. in recovery I ever heard. Wilbur Mills showed up, and his excuse, I don't know if you remember the circumstances, he was out with Fanny Fox, a stripper, and she decided to go swimming in the tidal basin in Washington, D.C., and the cops came, and before that, next thing you know, the police came, the park police and the city cops, and then reporters, and before you know it, he was finished as a Ways and Means chairperson, you know. Well, during one of the interviews that night, they said he was trying to get out of Dutch with being with Fanny. He said, my wife Polly usually is with us. You know, she comes with us when we go out. And unfortunately, tonight she's home. She broke her foot, you know, so that was why she wasn't there. So the joke in AA in that area was the next day a young fellow goes to the Will's house. He lived in a condominium in Arlington right across the river, and knocked on the door, and Mrs. Mills opened the door, and he said, Mrs. Mills, I'm from the office. I got some good news for you, and I got some bad news. I'll give you the good news first. Your husband was in town last night with Miss Fox, and she got in an altercation with the police after she was swimming in the tidal basin, and the police came, and the reporters came, and it's going to be all over the television this morning. And she says, my God, she said, that's the good news. What's the bad news? He says, I have to break your foot.
That is so funny.
He was one of the loveliest men if you ever had the chance to meet.
I'm sure.
He was an absolute saint, and stood at the door at the Annandale Friday night meeting for the next several years until he died. I'm Wilbur. Welcome to AA.
Wow, that is great.
Absolutely profound, yeah. I had the privilege of having him speak at my 7th anniversary. Never forget. First time he spoke, his sponsor was a guy by the name of Buck Doyle. And Buck was a real character. And he brought Wilbur up, and I had the force. I introduced him. I said, you know, when I got sober, I was afraid what the neighbors were going to say, you know. And I said, I'm going to introduce you now to a guy that when he got sober, he had to say, what's the world going to say, you know.
Yeah, really.
But he did a wonderful thing. You know, he was paranoid over, he thought he was going to choke to death on an ice cube. That's why he always kept his vodka in the refrigerator.
Wow, that is funny.
Yeah, good guy, really good guy. Well, I don't know, is there anything else you want to know?
No, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being on the show,
Bill. Thank you. Oh, good, I appreciate it. Any comment, again, on this, I'll send you, we have some actors now doing that Genesis bit up in New York.
And okay.
So if I get something good about that, I'll send it to you. But please, again, send me your itinerary. I'd like to get to meet you.
And, okay.
I'll make it a point to get there, all right?
All right, Bill. Thank you so
much.
Thank
you very much. The best, and thank you for what you do for us in the recovery community. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Bye.
All right, bye.